You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, which means our reporter roundtable is here. This is when we get you up to date on news that made headlines this last week, and there is a lot to get to. Our panel today, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Clark Corbin at the Idaho Capital Sun, Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com, and Kelsey Mosley Morris, also with the Idaho Capital Sun. Oh, happy Friday, everybody.
Hi, Gemma.
Hi.
Happy Friday.
Hi. All right, let's begin at the State House. And I want to start with teacher pay for Idaho public school teachers. I know Clark and Melissa, the two of you, have been watching this fairly quickly. So if you could both weigh in. So Melissa, why don't we have you start?
Absolutely. On Tuesday, the House killed on a tie vote the $1.1 billion appropriation that would fund teacher pay in Idaho. And those who voted against it, for the most part, said they weren't unhappy with the job that teachers were doing. Instead, they were concerned, and we've heard this before, about social justice curriculum and critical race theory being taught, you know, whether that was directly to students by teachers or coming up in teacher training. There's a $9 million appropriation that some of the lawmakers wanted to add what's called intent language to, basically saying none of this money can be spent on teacher training that goes toward talk about critical race theory.
So Clark, where are we right now then, since this bill was killed? What happens next?
You know, that's a good question. I think on one hand, it's sort of anybody's guess what happens next, but what's going to happen immediately is that bill is going to be redrafted. They're going to look to put that intent language in the bill that Melissa talked about. Several of the legislators who spoke said they didn't have a problem with the overall budget. They didn't have a problem with the funding through the career ladder. It was really that concern about the professional development, which is just really training that teachers receive every year as part of their continuing education. And so there was some talk about, oh, you know, we could do this and bring it right back within a day or two for a vote. But I believe it was Representative Rick Youngblood, the JFAT co-chair, said, no, we're maybe looking at 3 or 4 days here. And that sort of also depends on what happens with the other four budgets that make up the public school budget, which is the largest set of budgets that the legislature considers every year. And it accounts for about half of all of Idaho's general fund state spending. So it's a massive budget, but also we're in a place where the Constitution requires the state to pass a balanced budget, and it requires the state to operate these common system of free public schools. And so that budget would be due to take effect on July 1st and then serve the upcoming school year that would then start at the end of the summer.
I'm curious, and I don't know, Clark or Melissa, if you have an answer for this. Have teachers, administrators said anything about this? I mean, teachers have gone above and beyond this last year. Let's be just really clear about that in the midst of this pandemic. And I would think that this must feel like a slap in the face.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that, Gemma, that came up during the floor debate over this budget. And there were a couple of representatives who said, regardless of what your intention is, you know, this does look like a slap in the face to teachers. And with everything that's gone on between the remote learning and the hybrid learning and everybody adjusting to the coronavirus pandemic and opening and reopening, it's been a lot. And so that was something that Representative Linda Wright-Hartken, she's a Republican from Twin Falls, she supported the budget. And she said, quote, I just feel like we need to know whether or not the intent is there. Our teachers do take this as a slap in the face. And we also heard during the debate, there are a couple of legislators who are public school teachers. Representative John McCrosty, a Democrat from Garden City, is one. Representative Matthew Bundy, or a Republican from Mountain Home, is another. And they said, you know, they're on the ground. They're in our public schools, and they're not seeing this social justice, critical race theory training that these legislators were worried about and worked up about. They said that we're not seeing it here in Idaho. We're not seeing it in our classrooms.
Not only that, but Representative McCrosty said, I don't have time to do this. I don't have time to talk about critical race theory. He said, quote, that's nuts. He listed out all of the things, to your point, Gemma, that teachers have had to handle this past year, and said that, you know, that's just not happening, like Clark said. And I'll add that this comes as we are still waiting for the resurrection of that higher ed budget. We are, we still haven't heard the other public school budgets, likely for the same reason, because why put the floor through that debate if they know it's going to fail because of those similar concerns about social justice and critical race theory? And so there's a lot going on behind the scenes, but it's really hard to tell at this point how much progress they're actually making toward coming up with a compromise that'll make the very conservative lawmakers happy.
And Melissa, let's talk a little bit about what's going on with higher ed, because this goes back to this whole idea of social justice, critical race theory. And now there's another bill that's being introduced. Something in regards to ideological freedom on campus?
Right. And the basic idea of this bill that was sponsored by Representative Greg Cheney, it was heard in the Ways and Means Committee this morning. They're actually talking about it, I believe, right now. Correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. Clark. But the idea is that, yes, some of these conversations need to happen and should happen, but a student shouldn't be compelled to take classes that discuss it. And Representative Cheney said his goal is to find that compromise that people are looking for. This would, I believe, just apply to higher education. Again, we're still learning about the details. It hasn't been printed yet as of, you know, 12:15 mm-hmm. on Friday, but this is a situation that's developing as we speak right now. And so we're going to see a lot more movement and a lot more conversation on this next week when the legislature comes back.
Margaret, I want to bring you into the conversation because I'd like you to talk a little bit more about a certain issue in regards to the legislature wanting to change local election races to state election years. I know there's still a lot more to come on this issue, but talk to us about, you know, why we should be paying attention to this.
So this is super interesting, and it's going to have wide-ranging implications on the entire state's local government, if this does go through. So what ended up happening was in the 2020 session, the legislature passed a law that required cities over 100,000 to split their city council elections into districts. And at the time, this only impacted Meridian and Boise. But after it was signed, turns out there were some issues with the bill. It left some unresolved questions about the redistricting process, who draws those lines, as well as the fact that the current census data wouldn't, you know, the 2020 census would not be ready in time for the 2021 elections. So Senator Chuck Winder worked with the city of Boise and some other stakeholders and basically came up with a new bill that was going to fix these issues. It laid out, here's how we're going to transition to the districts and protect incumbents. Here's how we're going to draw the lines. And it answered all those questions. And that bill was sailing through with no problems. It was getting unanimously approved because it was basically like people were calling it a must pass. Like, this is going to resolve a problem in a bill. We need to fix it. And then when it hit the House, Representative Gand de Mondrant from, I think I said her name correctly, I hope I did,
De Mordaunt,
thank you, from Eagle, introduced an amendment that was kind of part of another bill she had proposed that would transition those elections over time to being held on even years instead of odd years. Mm-hmm. And what basically that does is it's going to put local elections in front of people the same time that they're going to be voting for governor, the state house, counties, just a long ballot. And so proponents like the representative who proposed it are saying, hey, this is going to get more people to vote. We're going to see higher turnout. We're not going to have a minority of people making these decisions. But people that oppose it, particularly Democrats, are saying, this is going to inject partisan politics into these races where there really wasn't supposed to be any before. And then it's just going to make it so people are going to be voting, more people will vote, but they won't be as informed because the noise of that governor race, that Senate race, that Congress race is going to, you know, kind of drown out what's going on at the cities. It passed the House, and now that bill is kicked back over to the Senate. So we'll see what they do with those amendments. I think that every local government reporter in the state is eagerly watching that, seeing what's going to come of it.
And Kelsey, sticking with the legislature, fill us in on the Child Nutrition Assistance Program and what's going on with the funding in regards to this.
Yeah, so this is actually a continuation of an assistant program that already existed for pandemic-related nutrition programs. It affects about 71,000 students in Idaho, I believe, the entire state. And it's for electronic benefit transfer cards that go to these students. There was a delay initially in the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee over the double counting per se, but it sort of looks like it is because it has to be appropriated to both the Department of Health and Welfare and the Department of Education. And okay. So Representative Ron Mate had some concerns about that being double counted. He wanted to adjust the appropriation for the Department of Health and Welfare as a result of having both in those categories. And so there was some minutia that went back and forth, but it was sorted out that both departments have to have those appropriated amounts to be able to administer the program. And it's a pass through from the Department of Health and Welfare to the Department of Education. So it ended up getting passed on, I believe it was Wednesday, along with some concern from Representative Wendy Horman about how we actually determine which students are in poverty in the schools. There's some concern about, I guess there's a federal requirement that doesn't create, it doesn't require the students to re-up their eligibility for the nutrition assistance program for 3 years. And
right. We don't have that in our state, right? That's the whole thing. We don't track that kind of data.
Right.
She said she wants to use like census data. She wants to look at like food stamp eligibility. And I think she said she, something about there are students that are not truly in poverty.
Yes. And so she wants to be able to have more specific data on those students and how often they are checked in on, I guess. And so we don't currently have that in our state, but other states do, I guess. And so she wants to look at that in the future. It didn't hold up the bill that was coming before them, but she did express that need.
So right now, it did pass, but the funding request still has to be approved by both chambers of the legislature, correct?
Correct. And especially in this session, you know, that's not a guaranteed thing. So it's definitely still
kind of up in the air. Isn't that the truth? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is so true. So Melissa, we just literally received a news release from Governor Little's office. What do we know about this? It seems a bit cryptic.
We know very little. The press release is two sentences long. It just says Governor Little will make an announcement regarding emergency powers today at 3 p.m. Mountain Time. The announcement will be broadcast to the public online. And so that could mean so many things. We know that the legislature has been very unhappy with the governor and those executive orders that were issued during the height and the beginning of the COVID pandemic here in Idaho. We know that there's pending legislation, that some of which has already made its way to the governor's desk. It could involve current executive orders that are out right now, and maybe some of those are being rescinded. We just don't know. I can tell you we'll be talking about it tonight on Idaho Reports at 8 p.m. on Idaho Public Television. But You know, as I said earlier in the show, so many things are happening right now. They're developing as we speak. This is one of the wilder legislative sessions I've covered.
Yeah, to say the least.
And this just adds to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, so Clark, with that email coming from the governor's office, for people who may not know as much or haven't maybe been following this as closely, talk to us about this true power struggle, right, in the legislature in regards to emergency orders, but also authority when it comes to Governor Little, right, and the authority that he has over the state.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jim. Along with killing budgets and scrutinizing spending, this power struggle over emergency orders and emergency powers has been one of the great themes of the legislative session. And in fact, it dates back to the special legislative session last August. As everybody remembers, Governor Little took a series of steps in 2020 designed to slow the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. There was a statewide stay-home order that I want to say was issued in late March of 2020.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and then that was eventually replaced by this tiered reopening plan that we saw. But legislators have been very concerned about the executive orders that the governor issued, including, you know, moving last spring's primary election to all absentee election, but particularly the emergency orders and the emergency powers. Legislators have been upset with that, but the governor has responded several times saying the reason that we have an emergency order in place and the reason all 50 states have an emergency order in place is because there is an emergency going on with the coronavirus pandemic. Idaho public health officials just tracked the 2000th death in the state of Idaho due to COVID-19, and we continue to see sometimes a couple hundred new cases a day. But this has been one of the defining issues of the session, one of the big debates. As Melissa mentioned, there is legislation that's made its way through the State House, including House Bill 135, which was designed to make it so that a governor could not extend an emergency order declaration past 60 days, except to continue to receive federal funding. It's this big power struggle right now between the legislature and feeling, you know, like they want to have more of a say. But obviously, one of the hallmarks of our state government is that we have a part-time citizen-driven legislature that is not in town all year. A typical legislative session is something on the order to 75 or 85 days. Today is the 96th day, and it's the longest legislative session in the past 10 years. And like you've talked about on the first part of the show, like Melissa mentioned, just so much uncertainty over where it goes from here and how much longer it lasts.
And it feels like it's been 96 days.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to get away from the legislature for a moment. We actually still have a lot more to cover with it. But Margaret, I think something that is top of mind for so many people, it's home prices, right? And especially during the pandemic, when we have seen so many people struggle to make rent, to pay their mortgage. And I think to say that home prices in Ada and Canyon County are skyrocketing is probably the understatement of the year. Can you talk to us about some of the reporting you've done recently and what you've found out about this?
Yeah, so should be no surprise to anybody, but we are still in this housing crunch and there is no end in sight for a variety of reasons. Some recent data that came out of the Intermountain Multiple Listing Real Estate Service is the median price for a home in Ada County is now $467,000 in March, and it's up 27% over March in 2020.
Wow.
And in Canyon County, it increased even more. The median price is now $386,000 in Canyon County, up from $271,000 a year ago, which is a 41% jump. So that's insane. Like, I think I can say that without being biased, without that being really a biased statement. Like, that's crazy. And that's really driven by a lot of things. We're still having this massive influx of population. There just aren't enough homes for the people who want to move here, the people who are here. And then plus we have this added constriction, and I'm going to have a story about this out next week, of just how much building materials have increased. It is so much more expensive to build a house because of the physical materials of it than it was a year ago. And so what this is doing is it's putting a hit on a lot of people's wallets. You know, if they're spending this much more on housing or they can't get into a house, then maybe they're going to have less money to go to the movie theater with their family or go out to eat or buy a new car, you know, insert whatever purchase. And so this is really going to constrain the economy. I'm guessing in the next couple of years, especially if that influx of population slows down, because wages are not keeping up, you know, median, the average wages have increased some, but they've stayed relatively flat compared to the huge increase we're seeing with prices. So no end in sight.
Yeah. And it was interesting, Margaret, I was reading a report in regards to this no end in sight, comparing it to the recession of 2007, 2008. And one of the things that experts look at is people not being able to make their mortgage payments, right? And going into default, and that's not happening. So, housing experts say that's an indication that we are not going to necessarily see this bubble pop anytime soon.
No, and something to keep in mind is like the Great Recession, and we've learned a lot more about exactly what happened the more years we get away from it, is that really that was built on a crisis in the subprime mortgage market, where we had these mortgages inside of mortgages inside of mortgages, and basically people gambling on the housing market and stretching their finances further and further. But really, we're not seeing that. I mean, a lot of this sharp increase in prices is due to, you know, whenever there's not enough supply, prices go up. And so that is kind of built on, whereas that last bubble and crisis was built on, say, you know, kind of arbitrary things in the economy and sort of like imaginary concepts of how much things are worth. Like these houses are worth, you know, this isn't just imaginary widgets, right? Like these houses are worth more because land is worth more and building materials are worth more, and there's not enough houses. You know, the last thing I'll say about this to keep in mind is like a normal, healthy housing market, they build houses every year around the country. Mm-hmm. You know, we build houses for people because our population is growing. But for about 3 years after that recession, nobody was building because there was no money in the economy, nothing was moving. But at the same time, where that 3 years where nobody was building, people were still having kids. People were still moving to the United States. And so that gap, that, you know, that delay in building of housing, it put us behind. And so that is a major reason why we don't have enough houses for people around the United States, not just in Boise, here a decade later.
And Kelsey, this kind of piggybacks on a recent survey of Boise residents regarding growth. Talk a little bit about that, because they're saying like it's just happening way too fast, correct?
Yeah, there was a survey by the Boise State University School of Public Service that happened at the end of November and early December and sampled about 750 residents in the Treasure Valley, asking them about whether they think the valley's growing too fast. And about 78% said that they think it is growing too fast. Only 16% said the pace was about right. And when they were asked, you know, if that was causing financial problems, more than half of them said no, but about 44% said that it was causing a little or a lot of strain on them.
Mm-hmm. So, Clark, it's been, I think, what, about 2 weeks since the legislature came back into session after a 2-week recess due to an outbreak of COVID-19. But the Senate is now in another recess.
Yeah, that's right. The Senate took the second recess of the year. The Senate actually abruptly went at recess on Wednesday morning this week. And yeah, you're exactly right. Everybody came back last week on Tuesday on April 6th after the first COVID recess. But this latest recess that the Senate is on right now, it extends till Monday, but there's a little bit different reason why. Senate Majority Leader Kelly Anthon, who's a Republican from Burley, stood up and said basically the Senate has very nearly finished all of its business for the year, but cannot move forward because there is so much uncertainty regarding the state budget. And so if you look at the big unfinished business, which is setting the budgets, maybe looking at transportation, maybe looking at taxes or perhaps property taxes specifically, the Senate said we can't act on that until we know what we're working with. And so you mentioned the recess. Since the legislature came back last week on April 6th, the House has killed three giant budgets. We've talked about the teacher salary budget bill. I think Melissa mentioned the higher education bill. They also killed the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare's Division of Welfare bill. And so the House has killed three major budgets just since coming back in the last 2 weeks. And the Senate said, we really have nowhere to go. The Senate had worked hard. They even held some evening floor sessions after coming back. And they said, really, we can't move forward until we know what we're working with, until the House works out its issues.
Not only have they killed those major budgets, Gemma, but they have also left a number of major budgets, including the rest of the public education budgets, on the reading calendar, meaning they likely don't think they have the votes to get those passed. So it's not just about the bills that they've killed. It's about the major ones that they haven't taken up. And you know, with Clark saying that the Senate GOP has released this press release, it's pretty clear that they're mad. The language in that press release is pretty acerbic, I would say. You know, they point out multiple times in the press release that came out on Wednesday that they've been working into the late evenings, and they have been passed more than 103 bills since they came back on April 6th, while the House has been working half days and adjourning around lunchtime. And as they put it, struggling to pass appropriation bills, quote, including Medicaid and those critical to funding Idaho's K-12 schools. And so they're not happy. And what is normally behind the scenes, that tension that's normally behind the scenes, is very public right now.
And I mean, it sounds like their anger is directed at the House, correct, Melissa? I mean, especially pointing out the difference in their work schedules.
I would say absolutely. It's pretty clear that when we had Senate President Pro Tem Chuck Winder on Idaho Reports last week, I flat out asked him, you know, you're working late into the evening. Are you sending a message to the House that it's time to wrap up? And he said, oh, absolutely. The Senate wanted to be done by today. And we know now that that's not happening, obviously. And so there are so many things that are left on the table. There's so much frustration that's boiling to the surface. And I think we're going to see that play out next week. We could see it play out in some pretty public ways, as we have in past legislative sessions.
And Melissa, can you talk about the joint resolution in regards to legalizing drugs in Idaho and what's happened with that?
Yeah, so this is this was the House version of a Senate joint resolution that had also passed the Senate. Basically, had it passed, it would have put on the ballot next year's general election whether or not Idaho wanted to put into its constitution that any future changes to Schedule 1 or 2 drugs as far as legalization would have to pass the legislation with a two-thirds majority. So in other words, if Idaho ever in the future wanted to legalize medical marijuana or anything along those lines, it would have to pass the legislature two-thirds majority. It was a lengthy debate, very emotional on both sides, representatives for and against this, bringing up really painful stories about family members battling addiction, family members who were battling chronic disease and relied or could have relied on medical marijuana. Ultimately, that bill, after a two-hour debate, did not get the two-thirds majority required to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot, even though a majority of lawmakers did support it. And so that issue is dead for this year. I imagine, depending on what happens with various voter initiatives on whether it's medical marijuana or flat out legalization of marijuana, this is not going to be the end of that conversation.
Oh, not even close. So Kelsey, get us updated on a JFAC approving a pretty big increase to the Idaho State Patrol in regards to their presence at the State House.
Yeah, so this is also kind of a continuation of what's been going on for the last year. The Idaho State Police has had a presence at the state capitol since a few months at least, but it was only supposed to be for the session that they kind of staffed right. up and gave extra personnel for security. And then they kind of decided that maybe they should have it for the rest of the year. And that was questioned by a couple of members of the committee, like, are there threats that we need to know about? Why do we need to do this for the next fiscal year? And they said no, there wasn't any continuing threat that they know of, but they didn't see last year coming either. And last year they had a graffiti incident at the front of the Capitol. They had people break down the glass door to the gallery because they were angry about some pandemic restrictions. And so, you know, they kind of decided that they need this for at least the next year to have some extra people there in case the protests happen or something unpredictable. And so they approved this increase that will get them through fiscal year 2022. And they actually approved a little bit extra for this last fiscal year as well.
And then Margaret, outside of the State House in the city of Boise, some new parking rules. Oh, I mean, things could really be changing in regards to some of this.
Yeah. So this is kind of an issue that I think a lot of people didn't expect to create a lot of tension, but it has. So about a month ago, City Councilmember Patrick Bajant proposed this ordinance that would basically close a loophole in the city's parking requirement that says, okay, you can park on the street for up to 3 days, 72 hours, and then you have to move. And when I mean move, you need to move a block more than 600 feet away. And, you know, because right now, because under the old code, if I had a car on the street, I could move it a foot up or a foot back and then avoid a ticket.
You moved it. Yeah.
I moved it. And so this ordinance that they passed on Tuesday night basically closes that loophole and passes Bajant's proposal of saying, if you're going to move, you got to really move. And this is kind of in response to some frustration from business owners who are dealing with maybe people blocking their access to their business, probably in more urban areas like downtown, as well as neighbors that have had disputes with frustrations with people that are parking campers, RVs, other things on the street. There's also been some concerns with it being difficult to address people who are living in RVs and their cars parking on the street for long periods of time. You know, the city can't really ticket them if they're moving until they've got this new ordinance. And this proposal got a lot of angry feedback. I know I got a lot of angry calls. I know my colleague at the Statesman, Haley Harding, got a lot of angry calls. People were upset about this, basically saying that it's going to create, just give people another tool to call the police on their neighbors and to you know, cause problems for people experiencing homelessness who are living in their car, living in an RV because they don't have another place to be. They don't have they cannot find a place. And right. so they passed this with the only council member objecting, voting against it, council member Lisa Sanchez, who cited her own experience having been struggling through the Great Recession and saying, I don't know if now is the right time to pass an ordinance like this. But everyone else in the council said, okay, I hear these concerns and we're going to watch and see if this results in people calling the police on their neighbors, harassment, these other issues, and then we'll go back and amend. So we'll see what happens with it. I know that a lot of people, especially who live in historic districts like the North End and the East End, where they don't have a garage, they have to park on the street, are pretty frustrated.
Yeah, understandably so. So Clark, before we take another break, can you talk about some folks who actually got to present a case to leave Oregon and join Idaho?
Yeah, this was kind of a wild hearing that we had earlier in the week, Gemma. And there were actually two legislative committees, a House committee, a Senate committee, got together. And they held this hearing, and the idea being that we would, this is a long shot proposal. I guess I need to preface it by saying that.
Yeah.
This long shot proposal to redraw the state border between Idaho and Oregon. So basically the idea being that 20 Oregon counties would join into Idaho and create this super state. And what the counties are talking about are kind of the more rural counties. There's kind of a funny map that the group published that sort of makes Idaho a lot bigger, and then it, you know, scoots right around Portland and Eugene and Northwest Oregon. But obviously there's some political motivations where these two speakers from Oregon, one, the former Speaker of the House of the Oregon Legislature, came and said that they don't feel like that their conservative patriotic values are being reflected in Oregon, and so they want to join Idaho. And it was kind of a bizarre thing to even hold a hearing about, but I thought that it was important just to let people know that this is the kind of thing that the legislature held a hearing on. There's no budget proposal. There's no bill before the legislature to do this. In fact, what they're doing is running a few ballot initiatives in rural Oregon counties to ask Oregon residents what they think of this. And so far, it appears that even Oregon residents are mixed on it, because in November it was on the ballot in four small rural Oregon counties, and it passed in two and failed in two others. So kind of a bizarre thing, but I thought that it became important when we had this legislative hearing specifically about it. So that was sort of a weird deal from a part of a very bizarre session.
Well, and in particular, Clark, when we have huge issues, as we've talked about already during the program, right? I mean, needing to balance the budget, in particular, in regards to public schools, to higher ed, transportation, yet, you know, they're spending their time holding a hearing on this.
Yeah, that's a great point, Gemma. And talking about the survey that Kelsey mentioned from Boise State University, yeah, Idahoans have a lot on their mind, whether it's property taxes, whether it's the coronavirus pandemic, whether it's making sure their roads and schools aren't falling apart. Some of the largest budgets in the state are unresolved right now. And Gemma, that's a great point, that was something that two legislative committees felt that they needed to stop everything else and hold a hearing on kind of this bizarre long shot effort.
Something else that I want to bring up is, when we talk about a long shot, like, let's talk about just how far of a long shot this is. So in order for this to pass, we need both houses of Idaho to approve this. We need both houses of Oregon, which is pretty democratic, to pass this. And we need Congress. Like, that is a really, really, I mean, this isn't just a lot. Like, we talk about Medicaid in 2018, like, oh, that was a long shot. Like, this is like going to Saturn, long shot. So no,
Margaret's exactly right.
I do like that analogy, Margaret, because you're absolutely right. Yeah. Melissa, what in the world is going on with the state representative being accused of unconsented sexual conduct with a House volunteer?
Gemma, I don't know. that's the short
answer.
There
we go. Yeah.
We have very, very little information, and it's very important to say that up front, that there has been an accusation that we know very, very little about, that there was unwanted sexual contact from Representative Aaron Von Ellinger out of Lewiston. He has denied that anything illegal or untoward happened. He has hired attorney David Leroy, who is, as you may recall, the former lieutenant governor and attorney general in Idaho. And so, and the House, he says he's cooperating with the House Ethics Committee. So as of right now, we don't know anything. We don't know the context, and the news was broken by Bill Spence of the Lewiston Tribune. And we are going to have to wait and see what more comes out of that.
Okay. Clark, the clock is ticking on Senate Bill 1110. Can you talk to us about this bill? And then we're waiting to hear from Governor Little.
Yeah, Jim, it is. The clock is ticking. That's an initiatives bill. And what that bill would do would change the signature gathering requirement to bring forward a citizen's ballot initiative or a referendum. And what it would do is it would change the current requirements to make it so that organizers of an initiative would have to gather signatures from, I want to say, 6% of the registered voters in all 35 of the state's legislative districts. And so what the supporters of this bill said is that it's all about ensuring that everybody from remote and rural corners of Idaho will have a say in the ballot initiative process. But what the people who opposed this bill and what Democrats said is that it will make it virtually impossible to get a ballot initiative forward and get it on the ballot before voters. And so the Medicaid expansion, that was a great example mm-hmm. of the last, one of the last big ballot initiatives that we saw. That came forward in the form of a ballot initiative. Governor Little has until late Saturday morning to act on this bill. It's passed both chambers of the legislature. The governor has basically three options. He can sign it into law, he can veto it, or he can allow it to become law without his signature. And so the clock's ticking. We expect to know by tomorrow, although we may or may not get word until Monday. But this is a bill that a lot of people have followed. There have been a number of bills in Idaho and all across the country that would change procedures for voting, for elections, for ballot initiatives. Former Idaho Supreme Court Justice Jim Jones delivered a petition of his own to Governor Little at the State House last week, calling on the governor to veto this bill. And so it'll be interesting. We have not heard from the governor yet as of when I joined the show at noon. And that's not surprising. Typically, the governor on a controversial piece of legislation may wait till the end, may not speak publicly until he's made his decision. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of Idahoans are following this one and following a lot of bills that would change, like I said, the initiative process, voting process, ballot processes.
Well, Clark, I mean, because a lot of people who are opposed to this, as you mentioned, they go back to Medicaid expansion and how difficult that was of a task to get it on the ballot, right? But then also this idea of if you can't get it on the ballot, well, then you're muting the voices of the citizens.
That's exactly a big part of the argument. We had a couple of legislators who said that they were opposed to ballot initiatives just outright because they think that's more a direct democracy, and they feel that this is a republic and it's a different form of government. But somebody else pointed out that this is in the Idaho Constitution. This is one of the mechanisms the citizens have to express their voice, and a lot of people will point out that the reason Medicaid expansion came forward was because that was the citizens taking it upon themselves to enact something that for years and years the legislature resisted. And so absolutely, it has to do with the voice of the citizens. It is a right that's enshrined in the Idaho State Constitution. But as I've written about it the last couple of weeks, you know, the legislature for a couple of decades at least has pushed back against citizen initiatives and ballot initiatives. I think it was like the 2002 legislative session, they repealed term limits, which Idaho voters had established in, I want to say, 1994 via ballot initiative. So Idaho legislators for years have pushed back against the initiative and referendum process. And a lot of eyes are on this bill right now as the clock is ticking.
And we have no idea, correct, Clark, on how the governor may go on this.
I don't have any insight one way or the other.
Okay. I know we didn't get to everything, but holy cow, you guys, so much to cover. And we're looking at the legislative session going for at least a few more weeks. So hang in there. I appreciate all of you. A big thanks to Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television. Of course, you can watch Melissa on Idaho Reports this evening at 8 p.m., as well as Clark Corbin and Kelsey Mosley Morris with the brand new Idaho Capital Sun. Give them a follow. And Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com. Of course, follow them as well. Thank you all so much. Have a good weekend.
Thank
you, Gemma. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. And I want to thank all of you, our listeners. Thank you for being a part of Idaho Matters, for supporting us, for supporting our station. We appreciate all of you as well. And a huge appreciation to my producers, Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. Our station manager is Paul Stribling. Our general manager is Tom Michael. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is Friday. I hope you can find some joy in your weekend, and we'll be back here on Monday.